This is Ron Stockton. I'm writing this podcast on October 8, 2023, the second day of the Israel-Hamas war. Yesterday morning, there was an explosion of thoughtful discussion as observers tried to figure out what was going on. Today, the media seemed to have lapsed into a predictable Israeli-centric commentary. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Hamas wants to kill Jews. Hamas has been offered peace and has refused it. The word terrorist has become a mantra to be repeated over and over. This is not helpful in trying to understand what is going on. At this point, 2 days in, there is so much that we don't know. And there is quite a bit of questionable information floating around. We have to be aware of that. But I have been asked my thoughts by several former students, and I feel an obligation to make some preliminary observations. This podcast will follow the format of what I would have called a briefing if I were still in the classroom. It is an effort to provide thoughtful insights, some context, some reflections on what might be happening, and a few thoughts on what might come next. In discussing these issues, I'm going to ask three things of you. First, my job is to be as detached as possible. I'm required to act as if human tragedy does not affect me, but I'm not detached. What is happening yesterday and in the coming weeks chills the blood. I have to put my personal feelings aside and play a more academic role. I hope you understand. Second, for my whole career, I have tried to use statistics to calculate the nature and outcome of violent conflicts. From Vietnam on, the concept of the kill ratio has proven useful. This sounds as if I'm indifferent to human suffering. I'm not indifferent to human suffering. What a kill ratio shows us is that when a technological army fights a popular resistance force, the numbers are heavily skewed. And yet, we as Americans learned as Vietnam... And yet, as we Americans learned in Vietnam, you cannot win a war with statistics. Third, let me emphasize that all conclusions are tentative. I reserve the right tomorrow to offer the exact opposite insight from anything I say today. And also, along the way, I will make reference to my other podcasts on various topics. I'm ultimately an educator and am pleased to refer you to other informational sources, even my own. This is not just self-promotion. So let's think of some historical context. Israel took over Gaza in 1967. It had been governed by Egypt since 1948, when it had been saved from Zionist conquest, as they would have said. Egypt never annexed it. They governed it. Egypt has always recognized the Palestinians as a distinct people. But in that war, Israel captured all the former Palestinian territories now under their control. That included Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. They also captured Syria's Golan province, not a part of historic Palestine. In the early days, Israeli shoppers would visit Gaza. They did that in a very informal manner, the way Americans and Mexicans crossed the Arizona-Mexico border on a casual basis. This was before the settlers began to arrive. Over time, Israel claimed a large part of Gaza as Jewish territory. Perhaps 4,000-plus settlers moved in, backed up by Israeli military forces. This was no longer just a conquest. It became something very different. In 1987, the First Intifada began. Intifada means an uprising against the occupation. It started in Gaza, when an Israeli vehicle crashed into a crowd of Palestinians. Soon there were protests and demonstrations across the whole of the occupied territories. 4 years later, there were 1,119 Palestinians dead and 48 Israelis dead, a kill ratio of 23-3. Almost all of the Israeli dead were military. Most of the Palestinian dead were civilian. Almost all of the deaths were in the occupied territories, not in Israel itself. Mostly, the Palestinians had used non-lethal violence, throwing rocks, Molotov cocktails, mass protests, etc. I have a podcast on this if you're interested. Out of that violence, there was a new Palestinian organization, Hamas. It was linked ideologically to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, but was born in military resistance. In 2009, Hamas took over control of Gaza in an election. They have governed it since. I have a podcast on the Hamas Charter of 1988, if you're interested. It has subsequently been replaced, but that original document shows a certain way of thinking. Then in 2000, the second Intifada started. It was called the Al-Aqsa Intifada. It was sparked by a visit of Ariel Sharon to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Up until that point, Israeli policy had been very strict about political figures visiting the mosque. Sharon went there with an armed guard of hundreds of soldiers. The uprising that followed was very different. It started with protests, but within a few months had shifted to lethal violence, suicide bombings, shootings, etc. Many of the Israeli targets were civilians. Many were in Israel itself. As you might expect, the Israelis responded with extreme force. By 2006, when the Palestinians declared a truce, there were 4,005 Palestinian dead and 1,017 Israeli dead, a kill ratio of 3.94:1. I have podcasts on the Al-Aqsa Intifada if you are interested. The 1993 Oslo Accords led to a Palestinian election and the creation of the Palestinian Authority, as it was called. Over the years, the Palestinian Authority has become authoritarian and sclerotic, that is, led by aging and corrupt leaders. It has little credibility. It keeps repeating the moribund slogan about a two-state solution, as if the Israelis would ever allow a strong, secure Palestinian state to emerge. Netanyahu has said it will never happen during his lifetime. The Palestinian Authority has strong security ties to the Israelis and frequently renounces terrorism, a code word for Hamas. They have little credibility. At this point, the only resistance to the Israeli occupation appears to come from Hamas. In 2005, just after the Al-Aqsa Intifada ended, Ariel Sharon decided that the cost of maintaining settlements in Gaza exceeded any benefits. At one point, there were more Israeli soldiers in Gaza protecting the settlers than there were settlers. Those on the Israeli right have insisted that Sharon meant this as a peace move, which the Palestinians refused to accept. This is pure propaganda. It was never a peace move, and Israel never gave up its occupation. They have surrounded Gaza with razor fence wires and security forces. It is impossible to leave Gaza or even go to the West Bank without permission. There was a noted case of a young woman who received a major scholarship to study in the U.S. but was denied an exit permit. It took a major U.S. intervention for her to be allowed to leave. What could the Israelis possibly have gained by this? I don't understand. It is virtually impossible to export anything, especially to Israel. The Israelis say those fruit baskets might have bombs in them. I was once in Gaza during harvest season for the amazing citrus crop that Gaza produces. The oranges were rotting on the trees. All of the customers in Europe had canceled their contracts. They could not rely on a steady flow of oranges for their orange juice or their fruit markets, so they went to other suppliers. Gaza lapsed into poverty even worse than it had been before. There have been periodic uprisings in Gaza over the years. 6, I think. One of the worst was 2014. It started when Hamas kidnapped 3 Israeli hikers. The Israelis swore that they would destroy Hamas once and for all. Their massive bombardment of Gaza produced extensive destruction. The fatality ratio was 1,801:60, a kill ratio of 31.35:1. International human rights groups describe their action as a war crime. Okay, let's pause for a moment. The concept of a war crime is not the same as genocide or a crime against humanity. Some people use those terms interchangeably, but they're not the same. A disproportionate use of force is considered a war crime. If someone kicks your dog and you hunt him down and kill him, that's disproportionate. The massive destruction and loss of life that occurred in Gaza in 2014 was considered a war crime. Okay, enough background. Let's get back to October 7th, 2023. I'm a light sleeper and I woke up that night at 3:30. I checked my cell phone to see if there was any news and realized that Israel and Hamas were at war. Well, that wrecked the rest of my night. What produced this explosion? Certainly it was a surprise to our officials. Jake Sullivan, the Deputy National Security Advisor, had said a month earlier that, quote, the region is quieter today than it has been for two decades. Jake, maybe you should check out my podcast and then reconsider that comment. I think there were several factors that converged to provoke the spark, as Mal would say. First, this was the 50th anniversary of the 1973 October War, in which Egypt and Syria decided to drive the Israeli army out of their land, specifically the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Province. This was not an attack on Israel as such. It was not an attempt to destroy Israel or to drive the Jews into the sea. I've been hearing that commentary for the last couple of days. Nor was it an effort even to defeat the Israeli forces, which Egypt and Syria knew they could not do. It was an effort to push the Israeli forces back, occupy and hold territory, and provoke an international crisis. I have a podcast on that war in case you're interested. It's very informative. The timing of the current attack was perfect, and the message is clear. Back to your own country, out of our land. Second, in the fall of 2023, the Israelis had been negotiating with the Saudis and UAE over what they called normalization. This was the so-called Abraham Accords, initiated by Jared Kushner and continued by the Biden administration. It seemed that mutual recognition was on the way. There had been meetings at high levels. The Saudis always insisted that there must be accommodation for the Palestinians before they would sign, but the Israeli right wing were very excited about this. They were openly talking about annexing the Jordan Valley and big chunks of the West Bank. They had already claimed East Jerusalem, the Palestinian part. Third, Netanyahu had put together the most extreme right-wing government in the history of Israel. There were people in his coalition who openly embraced the expulsion of the Palestinians. When Netanyahu and his government attempted to remove the power of the Supreme Court to review legislation or government action, there were protracted massive demonstrations, often involving over 100,000 people. I have a podcast on those events. While there were many issues involved in those clashes, thoughtful observers believe that one goal was to remove the Supreme Court as a possible impediment to a future move against the Palestinians. Fourth, the West Bank settlers had become very violent. According to one calculation, there had been 700 settler attacks against West Bank Palestinians in the first 9 months of 2023. Some of these were very violent. Finally, the hard-right members of the cabinet began to lead marches into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. These were political demonstrations often disguised as religious observance. At one point, the compound was swarmed, to use a word the Israeli press used. It is clear that they were not willing to honor the so-called status quo agreements by which the Israeli government recognized the right of Islamic leaders to control the holy site. Jews were allowed to visit, but not hold religious services. And in case you're confused, the rabbinical authorities agreed with those rules. There were also frequent military penetrations into the mosque, especially during Islamic religious holidays. In 2021, during Ramadan, there was a particularly aggressive penetration. Israeli soldiers went into the mosque and cut the wires used to broadcast the call to prayer. They also arrested the young men who were there to protect the mosque just in case the Israeli soldiers entered. At that point, Jewish religious practice by Jewish militants had become blatant and threatening. Previous governments had prohibited such demonstrative behavior. But some religio-nationalist militants looked forward to restoring the ancient temple, which would require removing the Dome of the Rock. And they felt they had some friendly cabinet members to support this behavior. It certainly seemed that Islam itself was at risk, especially when we remember that Al-Aqsa is the third holiest site in Islam after only the mosques in Mecca and Medina. Hamas gave the Israelis a time certain by which they should remove their troops from the mosque compound or they would begin shelling. Israel did not, and Hamas did, and the battle was on. It lasted 15 days. In the end, there were 260 dead Palestinians and 13 dead Israelis, a kill ratio of 20 to 1. The current attack began on October 7th, the day after the 50th anniversary of the 1973 war. 1,000 Hamas soldiers entered Israel by land, sea, and air, as the media put it. They broke through the fences and security barriers at 15 different points. Many ran or drove into Israel. They rode gliders into Israel. And they went by small boats into the coastal towns north of Gaza. This was a massive assault, and more are still arriving. The Israelis say there were 3,000 missile attacks on the first day. In the past, Hamas had inferior homemade rockets. I was once in Sderot, just near the border, and saw a collection of those that had not exploded. Some looked very primitive, as if they had been banged together in a neighborhood workshop. They seldom hit their targets. Even as I was there with some other professors, there was a red voice, as they call it, that a rocket had been fired in our direction. It landed in a field and never reached the city. The missiles used on October 7th appeared to be accurate and lethal. They hit Ashkelon, Tel Aviv, Hadera, Sderot, and even some neighborhoods in Jerusalem. The Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system is very effective. Perhaps 90% of targets are brought down, but the Iron Dome was overwhelmed by the massive barrage. There were just too many to stop. These Iron Dome missiles cost approximately $150,000 each. The U.S. provided $1.6 billion to develop the system and allocated $1 billion more in 2022. And they're promising to replace those that were used up this week. I think we can anticipate that more money will be allocated soon. Even those saying, "Why should we give money to protect Ukraine's border when we can't even protect our own border?" will vote yes on the anticipated Israeli aid package. The U.S. stores approximately $2 billion in weaponry in Israel. That is under American control, but we could turn whatever we wanted over to Israel. That could happen without a congressional vote. Israel said there was street-to-street combat in 22 different towns. The police station in Sderot was captured. If the police fought to hold that position, which surely had a large supply of weapons, we can assume that the whole force was wiped out or taken captive. This morning, the second day, there was still fighting in several of those towns. It is obvious that Hamas has taken territory and is holding it. Okay, update. At the beginning of the third day, Hamas still holds 6 locations. There are more combatants going into Israel to reinforce those already there. 900 Israelis have been killed at this point. There appears to be over 100 Israelis captured and taken back to Gaza. Hamas says 150. Some are soldiers, some civilians. Most observers anticipate that the captives will be spread around Gaza, especially in potential target buildings. Netanyahu has been given a no-win choice. He is making very belligerent statements about producing massive and unprecedented retaliation, the consequence of which will last for generations. As I finish up this podcast on the third day, Israel claims it has killed hundreds of terrorists with its first wave of bombardments. I suspect the definition of terrorist is fairly loose. They also say they kill 1,500 Hamas combatants within Israel itself. Well, Israel will have to decide if to put their military goals ahead of the lives of their captives. When you destroy a building, you will most likely kill an Israeli captive. Is that worth it? Will the public tolerate such a policy? Israel has mobilized its reserves, 300,000 of them. Then they called up another 50,000. They appear to be preparing for a massive ground invasion involving perhaps tens of thousands of Israeli soldiers going from place to place to kill Hamas leaders and to rescue hostages. This could involve weeks or even months of urban warfare. Every destroyed building will become a bunker. It will most certainly produce many Israeli combat deaths. One wonders how the Israeli public will react to this in a month. My suspicion is that Hamas will take photos of captives or invite them to ask to be rescued or exchanged. These photos will be broadcast from concealed sites. The Israelis will certainly be trying to track those broadcasts to find the captives. The psychological trauma of the Israeli public seeing their loved ones as captives will be enormous. Already, the few photos released are creating great public distress. Already, parents are begging for a safe return of their children. Already, various countries, the U.S. included, are asking their friends in the region and out to ask Hamas what they want in exchange for hostages. This will be very interesting to watch. Families say they have not had any contact from the government or military about their captured or missing or dead relatives. I suspect there is too much chaos on these first 2 days to get the paperwork in order. I also suspect this will soon turn to anger at Netanyahu and his government. The night before the attack, there was a rave held just nearby 3 miles from Gaza. For those who don't know, a rave is an all-night dance event, often with a DJ. There's usually a lot of alcohol involved. Just before dawn, that event was struck by missiles and subsequently attacked by soldiers. Israeli forces say they've recovered 260 bodies. Others were taken captive. There's a video of one young woman screaming for her boyfriend as she is taken away. She is later shown, unharmed, a captive drinking water. If she and others are killed during the rescue operation, no amount of thoughts and prayers will silence the public outcry. And yet, if she and others are left captive, there will also be an outcry. There's no happy outcome for this, for anyone. Hamas has called for all Palestinians in the West Bank or in Israel itself to conduct attacks. Use guns, knives, cars for ramming. So far, these attacks have not happened, but I anticipate at least some will, maybe more. Hamas is strong in the West Bank, and in the last few months, we've seen numerous individual attacks, apparently not organized by Hamas or any other group. Hamas has also called upon the Arab states to support them. I suspect they will send sweet words, but not much else. However, if this struggle is protracted, there may well be an Afghanistan pattern, such as happened in 1980, when Russia entered that country. Countries from around the world, led by the U.S. and key allies, recruited young militants from around the Arab world, giving them top training, and then infiltrated them into Afghanistan to join the struggle. Osama bin Laden was one of the people who helped with this program, although on his own rather than in cooperation with the U.S. Palestine is a powerful symbol of Islamic and Arab identity. The governments of the Arab states will probably be cautious, but individuals will respond to the call. I'm going to watch very carefully to see if there are demonstrations in Arab states, particularly Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and elsewhere. I once went to the Saudi Foreign Ministry in Riyadh and saw something worth noting. As you enter the building, there was a short wall facing the entrance. You would walk around it to the right or the left. But on that entryway wall, what you saw was a large photo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Saudi rulers have proclaimed themselves the protector of Islam. Their alliances may push them towards caution, but their public will be on the other side. And there are Saudi billionaires who care not what their leaders say. They're going to do what they can to help the Palestinians and to protect the holy sites of Jerusalem. The Western allies have lined up behind Israel. The U.S., Germany, France, Britain, Italy, and others have issued a joint statement. The Germans may cut off aid to the Palestinians, and they have broken up a demonstration in Berlin. It is too early to say for certain, but it looks as if the U.S.-NATO bloc is going in one direction and much of the rest of the world will go in another direction. A powerful country can do what it wants, within limits, but at a certain point, it has to recognize reality. Hamas has called their attack Al-Aqsa Deluge. Israel has named their response Operation Iron Swords. There's a lot of discussion of the intelligence failure. Greatest failure ever. As bad as 1973 when Israel failed to anticipate the Egyptian and Syrian attacks. How could this happen? And my personal favorite, headline in the Jerusalem Post, how could we be defeated by an inferior enemy? I have a thought on that. You can be defeated by a mindset that considers your opponent to be inferior. As the Bible says, pride goeth before a fall. Netanyahu has always thought he could manage the Palestinians. They rise up, we smack them down. Then they rise up again, we smack them down again, and so forth. This week shows that his management skills have fallen short. To me, it looks as if Netanyahu and his government have a response, but not a strategy. What do they hope to see in 50 years? Surely they cannot think the Palestinians will go away or become submissive. Let's think about this issue of intelligence. There's surveillance by drone or satellite. It tells where troops are concentrated, or when they are moving, or where supplies are stored. And there are informants, people within an organization who will tell you what you need to know. They are motivated by threats of exposure or rewards in terms of wealth and power. And there is signal intelligence, listening in on conversations. The Israelis are very good at all three. What we learned this week is that all three failed. Why, we might ask. David Ignatius in the Washington Post has a thesis. He speculates that the dots were all there, but nobody bothered to connect them. As in the U.S. before 9-1-1, the CIA and FBI and other agencies were jealous and competitive. Likewise in Israel, Mossad, Shin Bet, and military intelligence are not always in communication. And all three were suspicious of the Netanyahu government with its hard-right religio-nationalist ideology. Did they perhaps hold back information? Or maybe not share with each other? Or share selectively? We may never know, unless Israel has a 9-1-1 commission. But one thing we do know, the Israeli elite, security and political, seriously underestimated how smart Hamas was. Let me tell you what I think might have happened. The Hamas leaders, some of whom are very sophisticated, looked at their past few battles with Israel and asked themselves, what went wrong and how can we fix it? First, Israel has brilliant signals intelligence. They eavesdrop on everything we say, so we need to throw away our cell phones, or maybe have fake conversations to mislead them. It would not be the first time that a military unit sent out fake information. Remember the fake military buildup in England before D-Day to distract the Germans from Normandy? One thing is certain. There were a lot of 8-year-old boys running from place to place with messages in sealed envelopes. I know there were 8-year-old boys because one of my students played exactly that role during the Biafra independence struggle. He and his friends would hang around the government bases, playing with the soldiers and listening to their conversations. Young boys are cute. They're innocent. And they can be lethal. And no signals device can pick up their messages. Second, Hamas knew that firing homemade rockets just brought about disaster. Where did they get their new and improved rockets is not clear. Maybe Iran? Maybe somewhere else? And how did they get into Gaza? I don't know, but those missiles were better than Hamas ever had before. And firing them in massive waves to overwhelm the Iron Dome defensive system was very effective. So the Israelis shoot down 60% or 80% of them. The rest get through. And they hit Israel where it hurts. Tel Aviv, Ashkelon, Jerusalem. Third, they knew that Israel would respond with massive aerial bombardments. In an escalation, Israel would lose a few dozen lives and some houses, but Gaza would lose thousands of lives and whole neighborhoods. How could they handle that? Kidnapping Israelis and positioning them in buildings around the strip will make the Israelis hesitate. We don't know what Israel will do, but bombing Gaza to the ground will mean killing over 100 Israelis, maybe 150. Each of whom will have enraged families. Fourth, sitting in Gaza and firing shells at Israel was not working. 2 days ago, Hamas set up positions within Israel itself. They took control of Israeli cities. And if there is a parallel action in the West Bank, where Hamas also has a strong presence, then Israel will be fighting on a two-front war. I read an interesting interview with a Hamas leader based in Beirut. He said that the training for this attack took about a year. Only a handful of people knew what was planned. Even the top field commanders did not know. The central leadership discussed their plans in a sealed room, safe from Israeli penetration. Hamas created a fake Israeli town for training purposes. The men were not told what they were training to do. In this whole operation, there was not a single leak. The Israelis were taken completely by surprise. When the Americans promise additional intelligence resources, they're missing the point, just the way the Israelis missed the point. However, the settlers in the West Bank have been so aggressive that the military shifted troops from the southern command, i.e. Gaza, to the West Bank to protect them. The Hamas officials said they were anticipating a massive response from the Israelis, but as they poured across the border, they got no meaningful response. And when they entered the IDF command building, they were able to immobilize the communication system so the various units could not coordinate among themselves. Let me explain this. There are about 480,000 Jews on the West Bank. They live in 327 different communities. 127 of these are legal settlements. Legal under Israeli law. Under international law, none of them are legal. There are also 200 non-authorized settlements. These are all spread so far apart that it is hard to protect them. Israel had to shift troops from the southern command to the West Bank. That is why the Hamas soldiers were stunned to realize that there was no meaningful resistance when they crossed the border. It reminds me of what happened when the Bush administration shifted troops from Afghanistan to Iraq and left our Afghan plans seriously undermined. And should I note that if Israel is going to focus upon Gaza, they will once again expose West Bank settlers to attacks? Hamas is not trying to destroy Israel. They are not trying to drive the Jews into the sea. I suspect they are trying a Sadat 73 strategy. Grab territory inside of the Israeli zone and hold on to it. Create a crisis that will entangle the Americans and their allies in a quagmire. Will American cities or synagogues be at risk? Maybe, but I doubt it. What will happen is that the Americans will discover that they are being dragged into a situation that they cannot resolve and cannot escape. Think of Jimmy Carter in 1980. The Iranians held American hostages. That cost him almost nothing in terms of military resources, and yet it caused the Carter presidency to crash. Already Biden's Republican opponents are saying that this is his fault. He's a weak leader. This would not have happened if Republicans had controlled the White House. Biden gave billions of American dollars to Iran, and Iran is using that money to fund this war. None of that is true. None of the Iranian money unfrozen recently has been moved. But it sounds good, especially if you say it with passion and repeat it over and over, and the public really doesn't know the facts. On this point, the Wall Street Journal has argued that the Iranians were behind the attack. They planned it. They sponsored it. It was their operation. U.S. intelligence says there is no evidence of this. These arguments that Arabs are not capable of organizing an effective attack themselves seems to me to be rooted in some form of racism. I'm reminded of the polls after Pearl Harbor that showed a majority of Americans believing that Germans had piloted the planes that attacked the American fleet. Obviously, the Japanese were not capable of such sophisticated and effective attacks. The Americans were very wrong, and I suspect that those spreading the Iran hypothesis are also wrong. And I also want to mention that Egypt says they had warned Israel of a planned attack that would be massive. Israel has denied this. I guess we'll see what we will see. Once again, thinking of the U.S., how can Biden handle this, especially if it continues on and on, month after month? And how long do you think it will take for Israel to get those hostages back? And what will it cost them? At this point, the Abraham Accords look moribund. The thought of Bibi in Riyadh shaking hands with the Saudi crown prince now sounds delusional. That photo op was to go down in history. Bibi and Mohammed bin Salman would get Nobel Peace Prizes. It would be greater than Clinton presiding over the famous Rabin-Arafat handshake. The world would praise them. But in that scenario, the Palestinians would get nothing. Or maybe some peanuts. Or maybe a few hills and piles of sand in the south for something that would be called a state. Or maybe they would get a few billion dollars turned over to their leaders for diversion to overseas investment. And Hamas says no, no, no. I suspect Bibi's career is over. He has been humiliated and defeated. His bombastic threats will work for a few months. He is going to bring a mighty vengeance. He is going to destroy Hamas completely. But what then? What happens when they can only deliver dead Palestinians? What will happen when the public demands to know how this was allowed to happen? Why did he spend months trying to weaken the Supreme Court when he could have been focusing on Israeli security, his traditional strength? How long until parents start renouncing him and his opponents calling him incompetent and past his sell-by date? Well, in fact, they already have. Is Netanyahu really going to send thousands of Israeli soldiers into the streets of Gaza, going from building to building looking for Israeli hostages? Actually, he may. But how many Israeli lives will that cost? And will the public consider it worthwhile, or will they think Netanyahu is just trying to salvage his career? Back in the U.S., Biden's candidacy will be weakened. He is offering Israel unwavering support. His commitments are ironclad. But will he be able to stick it out? When a dozen American soldiers died during the evacuation from Afghanistan, it escalated quickly into second-guessing and Monday morning quarterbacking and widespread condemnation. Surely congressional hearings will soon follow. Who knows how this will evolve? Let me just offer a personal comment. No matter how much anyone out there sympathizes with the Palestinians and their determination to resist their oppression, the brutality of what happened yesterday is shocking. Going through a party and executing young people is horrifying. I know the data. 251 Israelis and 5,590 Palestinians killed in the last 12 years, a kill ratio of 22-1. I also remember my favorite wall sign. Take what you want, said God, and pay for it. Certainly the Israelis have taken. Perhaps now it is time to pay. But I also remember what Che Guevara said. The tragedy is that it is historical forces at war, but it is individuals who die. Maybe inflicting extreme psychological trauma on the Israelis, something being compared with American trauma after 9/11, was their only viable option. American public opinion turned against the Vietnam War after the Tet Offensive in 1968. Israel had never had its Tet Offensive. This week they had it. It bothers me to think that if I were an Israeli who had lost a child in that rave, I would be seeking vengeance and would be thrilled to hear Netanyahu say that Israel was going to inflict extreme violent retaliation upon the Palestinians in Gaza. We know what those words mean. Many, many dead Palestinians, large proportions being women and children and other non-combatants. But I would be cheering. At the same time, I think that if I were a Palestinian and had lost a son in that attack, I would be giving sweet tea and pastries to everyone who came by to offer sympathies. And to every young man who came by, I would say, you can avenge him. And if I were living in the West Bank, I would be saying, at last, someone has done something that might actually make a difference. And now, what can we do to help? If you haven't been able to put yourself into the shoes of both Israelis and Palestinians so you can understand this point, then you need to think more deeply. Maybe it would help to think of two of my rules of good studenting. First, if you can't explain someone's point of view to their satisfaction and defend it from its critics, then you don't understand it well enough to know if you agree or disagree. And second, remember that if you were there, you would be there. If you were in that situation, you would do everything that anyone we encounter has done. I know you think you wouldn't, but you would. So what about Hezbollah sitting there in southern Lebanon, right on the Israeli border? They have made a strong statement on behalf of the Palestinians and their right to resist the occupation. But many of you could say the same thing. Words cost nothing. And they've been shelling into the Shabbat farms. What is that, you ask? It's a small piece of land in southern Lebanon that the Lebanese say is a part of their country. The Israelis have some argument about some letter or map written 80 years or so ago that says it is part of the Golan, so Israel says they own it. It appears to have no value, economic or strategic. I've never been able to understand why the Israelis are willing to give up lives for that place where nobody lives. Shelling there will let Hezbollah claim they are playing a role, but will not cost them anything. But do remember that Hezbollah has a powerful combat force with combat experience in Syria. If they entered the battle, it would make a big difference. Lebanon would be devastated by the Israelis, but things happen. I don't think this will happen, but somewhere out there is a second shoe waiting to drop. Gaza is a small place. 2.4 million people live in 144 square miles. That is about the size of Detroit. But that comparison is misleading. Much of Gaza is too dry to support more than a minimal population. And much of it is a dead zone around the Israeli razor wire fences. Anyone entering that zone is exposed to live fire. Observers have described Gaza as the largest open-air prison in the world. They say the guards just moved outside of the prison. I've been to Gaza a couple of times and have to agree with that description. And the security checks are humiliating. And to the west, the Egyptian border is as tight as the Israeli border. Getting in or out from any direction is nearly impossible. Right now, Israel is stronger than it has ever been. It is strong economically, militarily, diplomatically, and in terms of intelligence and technology. And yet, it is vulnerable. People are saying that this is Israel's 9-1-1, which I understand, or their Tet Offensive, which I also understand, or even their Pearl Harbor, which makes much less sense, but I get the point about trauma and surprise. I think the best analogy is the one I used with my students after September 11th, David and Goliath. Goliath was a giant with enormous strength and powerful armor, and yet he was brought down by a slingshot and a smooth stone thrown by a young boy who did not even wear armor. Israel has been stunned by a rock between their eyes, thrown by someone whose capacity they treated with contempt. Of course, this could turn into a catastrophe for Hamas. Remember what happened to the IRA in 1915 in the Easter Uprising? They took over the big government building, the post office, in the middle of Dublin, barricaded themselves in, and called for the people of Ireland to rise up. Nothing happened, and most were executed. Except for Eamon de Valera, the future president of Ireland, who had an American passport. Good luck for you. But in the long run, the British were driven out. In that case, the long run took over 70 years of struggle and blood. And Ireland had the sea. The sea, oh, the sea, the beautiful sea, long may it flow between England and me. It's a sure guarantee that some hour we'll be free. Thank God we're surrounded by water. Alas for Palestine, they are not surrounded by water, nor are the Israelis. Thanks for listening.